back for another episode. It is Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. Glad you could be here just to see the show. You know, we've got a lot going on. Eric is here with me, as usual.
Usually am when we do
when we do the Box Office
Battles with Greg and Eric. But when it's Box Office Battles with Greg and you just get on here and talk to yourself, I'm not here for that. I will never be here for that.
You will not? Just not.
What are you wearing? Is that a Red Wings?
It is. I'm trying to give them good juju. They started off the season so well. So it's a Red Wings jersey. Sorry, I interrupted you, but yes, Detroit Red Wings. My whole
this town. This is hockey.
Hockey, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Boring. All right, then we'll just skip over it. They need to try to get in the playoffs. They haven't been in the playoffs for a long time, so I'm trying everything I can. You know, let's bring them good luck. Support the
team. That Sergei Fedorov still playing for them?
Not for a while.
Oh,
not for a while.
Steve Yzerman.
Actually, yes, he's still. No, he's not still playing for them. He retired a long time ago. He is the general manager, believe it or not.
Well, we've run through all of the former Detroit Red Wings, I know, from playing NHL 94, I would imagine.
One of the stars of the U.S. Olympic gold-winning hockey team was Dylan Larkin, and he plays for the Detroit Red Wings.
We're going to have a President Dylan pretty soon, aren't we? Or like President Caden, or just some fucking...
Tyler...
Yeah, just some bullshit fucking name, and you won't be able to take him seriously. I mean, I can't take any of it seriously anymore.
Oh, what's like, some other good president names?
What are these fucking jerk-off kids' names? Like, sorry, I'm going to just derail the show.
Are you?
The entire time. Most popular boy names 2025. Oh, President Liam. No, I don't.
Little Oasis fans are naming their kids now.
President Hudson.
Hudson would be good.
Oh, God. Goodness. I will refuse to be governed by a Hudson or a Caden or whatever.
Or a Baron.
Or a Baron. Yeah. I'll be long gone, I hope. And listen. I'm allowed to, like, if you're out there and you're like, wait a second, my kid's got one of these, you know, stupid ass fucking names. My kids have stupid ass fucking names too. Eller, Greer. Like, I get it.
Yep.
So I am not being hypocritical when I say those names are fucking stupid.
Did you choose your children's names?
No. The only part that I had to do with anything is once Eller's name was confirmed, I insisted that the middle name be Franklin because that's my dad's middle name and that's my granddad's middle name.
Okay.
It's not my middle name, but just a tribute to those two dudes who are pretty good. Their lineage runs strong with me.
That's good.
They never had a podcast.
When they grow up and decide to change their name completely, then you'll feel very betrayed and bitter.
I'm already bitter, so they can't really do anything about that.
Dad, my new name is Xenon. I'm gonna be.
What? Maybe they're gonna. Maybe we'll go through a thing where they just change it back to like normal names because they realize we've gone too far with all this, and so they're just like, my new name is Bruce. Gary,
Sam, you know,
yeah, Randy, just
Bill,
like names that you don't hear. Like, you go up to the school, poll, you know, every teacher there, be like, how many Brians do you have?
Yeah,
how many
Eds? How many Eds do you have?
Oh, I'm sure Edward's like back around because it's like ironically
Ed. I mean, Eddie maybe, but Ed or Bill. If there's an Ed or Bill in the school, I'm bringing him home to fix my sink because that's a plumber's name. So that's what I want.
That is a plumber's name. That's a good point.
Bill the plumber.
All right. Well, go Red Wings. We hope you make it to the sports game championship. I've watched 6 minutes of hockey since Joe Nieuwendyk retired. So nice. That's
I remember about those it. Days. Yeah, well, you didn't watch any of the Olympics, the Winter Olympics hockey, both the men and women both won gold. It was great.
I also watched about 6 minutes of the Olympics.
All right. In those 6 minutes, what did you catch? Because it had to have been, I mean, there's a lot of minutes. I watched a lot of the Olympics.
Tell me why we already know that the luge is fucking crazy.
Yes.
And dangerous and looks like it goes really fast. Now, I'm not an expert. Tell me why we decided that going down feet first wasn't enough. And we've got an event now called the skeleton.
Yes.
Where they go head first.
Right.
Down this fucker.
Right.
So I caught a little bit of that.
Did you see the doubles one where they're stacked on top of
and each other? That was way hotter, obviously. Especially when it was two dudes. And you just knew that, like, here's how I imagine it works. Okay. You grow up and you're like, you live in some like Nordic area or I don't know, like your wife's from like Northern Maine. Maybe you're from somewhere like that.
Right.
You're like, I'm going to be a luger. A lugist.
A lugist, yes.
And okay, well, not everyone can make the luge team, right? Because you just have to, you can only send your best two guys. It's like, okay, well, I can't do that. I'll do the skeleton. Then it's like, well, we can only send two guys to do that too. But if you're interested, we could have another man lay on top of you. And you have to be wearing Lycra or whatever, spandex,
really, really
or whatever
tight,
it is.
Tight spandex.
And we'll know if you're circumcised or not.
Definitely based found that
on the outline. And I don't know. It just seems like, I don't know. That was weird. Then there was a big curling controversy. I don't know if you caught this. You're not supposed to touch the stone after you release it.
That's probably one of my favorite moments of the Olympics was the stone touching.
Bunch of bullshit.
What I loved was how indignant the Canadian got when he got called out on it. And you can always see the video where he touches it. And he's like, fuck you.
Look, I think he handled it with great aplomb. That's how I would have handled it.
Oh, it was great.
That's how I handle it at work when someone points out something I did wrong. Fuck you. Fuck you.
People tend to believe you when you throw profanity at them if you've done something wrong. If you've wronged them. Dude, did you just take my fries? Fuck you. I didn't take your fucking fries. As I eat them in front of you. These were my fucking fries.
But in an unrelated note, do you have any ketchup? I just keep a list of everyone at work who's ever done anything wrong that I've ever just let slide. Just fixed it on my own or sent an email back and glossed over the part where they fucked up. But I do keep a list of it.
Good. Good.
And then when things start getting hairy, then I start pulling it out. And I'm like, per your email, May 24th, 2011. And I just start typing away.
I hope there's never a shooting at your work that you had nothing to do with. And they find your list. And coincidentally.
You're right. I should rethink it.
You should not make a list of people at work. That could never go well.
No, oh, my God. So when you start making lists of any kind, you start to know.
Oh, it's real. Oh, my goodness. What are we doing?
And then Eller, there was this biathlon.
Right. Yes.
And it's skiing, and then they shoot a gun.
Yeah, that's pretty
cool. Eller just kept looking at, well, you know, the way they set that course up is like you ski around, but then you just ski in kind of a big circle for a little while. Mm-hmm. They don't have like this big trail mapped out.
Yeah.
And so you do your shooting. Sorry, I'm really emotional about it. You do your shooting. And you got to ski around like 10 times and go shoot some more. And Eller just kept looking at me like, why are they doing this? And I'm like, well, I'm sure that it had to do with like military training back in the day. And then they've just taken that and turned it into this event. So, you know, the cardio that it takes to do the skiing, and then you've got to kind of compose your body and compose your breathing and, you know, shoot these targets and whatever. And he just was like, that still doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. And I don't know. It seems like an awful lot of work for not a lot of payoff. Like,
right.
we can probably name, I mean, I can't name the last person to win the 100-meter dash.
Right.
I don't know if they call it that anymore, the dash. But
are you talking about the Summer Olympics?
Yeah, but I know Carl Lewis and Ben Johnson, and I know Usain Bolt. And, like, these are people that you'll remember.
Right.
You know, I remember Dan and Dave doing the decathlon and whatever.
Dan and Dave? I don't
remember. You don't remember Dave and Dan and Dave?
I remember Bruce Jenner.
Well, what has he gotten? Linda or what is it now?
Caitlin. Is it?
No.
Yeah, Caitlin.
You don't remember Reebok had this big, like, ad campaign where Dan and Dave were going to compete at the Barcelona Olympics. And they were going to whip everybody's ass.
Right. They weren't real athletes, though. It was just
they were real athletes. They were.
Okay.
But they hadn't even gone through the American, like, trials or you got to do here to get to go there.
Yep.
And only one of them fucking made it. And so it was either Dan or Dave.
One of them. Yeah.
It was one of them.
Crazy. And
so then this whole ad campaign was just built around false pretenses.
They should have waited until they both made it, and then they could have done the ad campaign.
What do you call that? Olympic trials?
The trials. Yep. Yeah. And they go through the trials to get there. I think with the biathlon, it would be more interesting if they ran live deer past where they're supposed to shoot.
Because I thought you were going to say it'd be more interesting if they had to have sex with a person of their own sex and the opposite sex. No,
that's the dual skeleton. We already covered that. But no, it would be interesting because they're shooting and it kind of has that origins. And that's why the Norwegians do so fucking well at it. And they won every medal in the cross-country skiing and biathlons because they can shoot and they can ski. Because they, you know, they had to hunt for their meals in Norway before they civilized it.
Seems like the deer would be pretty unpredictable.
Would be
and
fun. Would if they charge
like you send one out there and they watch it just get shot and like are the others gonna be willing to participate?
You have them in a pen and you just tail prop them
out. Well, you've got a new idea for
granted. PETA would not be happy, so we've got to keep this quiet until the actual event starts. We can't advertise. We just trot this out, and we're just giving it a go, and then we see what happens. And it would be more challenging, because if the deer all of a sudden mounted a counteroffensive and started to charge the hunters,
and they learn how to use guns.
It could be a great event. See, three deer on the podium,
like
getting
like
their Squid Olympic medals. Squid
Games. With the deer fight back.
You hang the little gold medal off their antlers after they win the biathlon. It'd be great.
Have you ever had anything taxidermied?
No, I have not. But I have lived with people or been over their house that have had it done. So I've seen it up close, but I've never personally had anything stuffed, no.
I haven't either. Except my butt one time. But my granddad used to catch pretty big fish up at Lake Texoma, and he'd get those like taxidermied, and it would be like the fish was jumping out of the water and it was on like a stump, you know, like a wood thing, you know, and it was all fancy and whatever. And I guess that's like okay, although it still seems weird, but I just find the whole taxidermy thing like really odd. But you know, there's people who like their pets die and they instead of
I couldn't do it. Couldn't do it.
Just to have it like sitting there they are only gonna just put like marbles in for their eyeballs and like you know that's not what their eyeballs look like. And seems weird to me.
I just lost my dog and I couldn't imagine. I can't even look at pictures of him, much less have him just sitting there. My wife would probably put him at the door so when I came in he would just be waiting there like normal. Oh no, that would be not gonna go there. But anyway,
well,
we got way off track.
Clarissa says hey guys, I missed the chaos. And yeah, you walked right into it, didn't you?
Hi, Clarissa. Exactly. And that's, you know, sometimes it's good to get some things out. We hadn't talked in a couple weeks, so hi, Clarissa. Hi, Mike. Mike is out there in the audience tonight, and I'm sure people will be coming and going throughout the evening.
Being mad at you.
What'd you say? Who?
He stopped being mad at you, Mike.
Yes, he's back. He's back, and he's early this time. Yeah, so the thing is that we'll have people coming and going throughout the night, and we just want to welcome you to Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. Whether you're listening to us on the regular podcast, we appreciate you. Whether you're listening on Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, or any of the other providers that are out there, we are on umpteen of them. I don't know how many is an umpteen, but we are on an umpteen of podcast providers. So we appreciate you listening. And if you're just tuning in for the live stream, whether that's on Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod, or if it's on YouTube at Box Office Battle Podcast, or if you've gone to our Facebook page and watched it there, we appreciate you as well. We always ask for your comments and suggestions. You can either go and leave comments on our Facebook page, or you can email us at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. We have been getting a influx of emails from companies that want to help us with the podcast, that want to produce and promote. Really, they just want us to spend money and give us very little in return. So
I'm not barking up the wrong tree, folks. We don't have any money.
Exactly.
Never had any money. If we had money, wouldn't look like this.
No.
But yeah, where can people find us? Spotify and Zintra, Quibbly, Furious,
Quidditch,
Draft Mint,
Bumble,
Invoxia. I don't know.
Isn't that medication?
I don't know. You just make up any name.
I think I saw a commercial for that prescription, Invoxia.
Yeah, tune in on Dash Loop. I don't know. Whatever.
Side effects of Invoxia, maybe anal leakage.
Remember when we did, is this a Pokemon or is this a prescription medication round for trivia?
Yes, that was great. Yeah, we could do that on this show. You never know.
Oh, all right.
It's good stuff. But what we're here to do is to discuss two movies that we pit head to head for your enjoyment. And tonight is the last of the first round battles. We have the last two. I think this is fourth and the fifth seed, if I'm not mistaken. We'll find out when I look at the bracket here in a second. But it's the Five Heartbeats versus the Commitments. And I'm right. It is the fourth versus the fifth seed. If you look at the bracket there, this is how far we've come. We have Almost Famous has beaten Eddie and the Cruisers. The Blues Brothers squeaked by That Thing You Do. And this is Spinal Tap beat a very good movie, NSYNC Street. So we have three of the four. And tonight, we are going to decide the fourth final movie in the tournament. And then next week, we will discuss who the winner of this best movie band. So if you were here for most of the other episodes, and we hope you have been, what we're doing is looking at bands that were created specifically for a movie. This is not like a biopic. I have to always make sure I say that right, or Eric will lose it. I can't say biopic. I know,
but now it's starting to sound weird the way I know,
because I'm deliberately, right way. I'm walking on eggshells. I'm deliberately going,
I'm sorry that I've made you so nervous.
Biopic. So it's not a biopic. So it's not like Bohemian Rhapsody. It is about a band or a movie or a screenplay that was built on a fictional band. And that's what these are, fictional movie bands. We're trying to determine which ones are the best. And we've had three battles so far, and we're down to the last one.
We've already determined it.
We have? We predetermined?
Well, no, but I mean, we're going to get to the bottom of this. And then when anybody Googles, like, what's the best band movie, not biopic.
Did you do that on purpose?
Yeah. Okay. But I'm going to come. I've been coming around on biopic. I think about it more than you might think. Like, I was taking a shower the other day and I was just standing there, you know, as the water and the tears ran down.
Were you sitting?
Yeah, I was sitting. And I was like, I really need to clean this shower. But I just kept like mouthing, like, biopic. Biopic. And you know, the more you say a word, the weirder it sounds. And then saying it the right way started sounding weird. And I was like, maybe Greg's onto something. Anyway, all right.
So yes, you could say it however you want, but these are not biopics. I have to think about it. I can't just say it. I have to think about it. So these are not biopics. These are fictional movie bands that were in there. And we've got the last two of them. So we're going to start with the Five Heartbeats, which is the lower seed, really fourth and fifth seed. So these movies are very close. We talked about it before the show that they're very close in IMDb scores. They were very close in box office. Neither one of them pulled a ton of money into the box office, but they both had about the same.
I don't know. It feels like every time I look one of these up and it's like, did really shitty in the box office, but has a cult following now.
Yes.
And it's like, I think you're just saying that. Like, not every movie can have a cult following.
You know what? The thing is, I do think that in the late 80s, early 90s, throughout the 90s, you could gain a cult following very easily because of Blockbuster and the video stores. Because a lot of people they'd go to the movies, but they'd go for the big ones, and then they just wait for a video. Kind of like people do now with the streaming, but I think when you had the video cassettes, it kind of could gauge the popularity, because it was always rented out, you know? So I think both of these films were one of those that people waited till it came out on video and watched it at home and then gained a following. I will say, I know people who love both of these films for different reasons, that these are two of their favorite movies about fictional bands of all time. I know people.
What?
I know people. Is that a surprise?
No. Many people are saying the nicest of movie people. Okay, not only did both of these movies came out in 1991.
Yes.
You could have gone to see each of these in the theater in the same year. The year I turned 14.
There you go.
The year you turned 31.
Thanks.
But they also have the same exact IMDb rating down to the decimal.
That's 7.6. That is crazy.
What do you think it means?
I think that people kind of love these movies in their own way, and they're equal. But they're totally different. I mean, look at the movie posters. they're night and day.
There's one very noticeable.
I'm just saying.
You said it that way on purpose.
No, I'm just saying. Day. They're yin and yang. So they're the same but different. They're musical movies about bands that are formed. They both sing soul, which is important.
Yeah.
And so they're very similar.
Some better than others.
Yes.
But sure. Yeah.
They're both really good films, but they reach different audiences and they have cult followings. I don't think they have the same cult following. I think they do.
I don't think so. Do.
And I'm not saying that in a racial sense. I think that there is.
You are.
Well, okay, so I am. So I think that a segment of the population that our African American black population would love the Five Heartbeats. I like the Five Heartbeats. I think people that are Irish, that are from Ireland, love the Commitments a lot more.
Oh my God.
So there's Greg. Where the divide is. It's some people in America.
Controversial take.
Some people in America love the Five Heartbeats, and the people in Ireland and maybe not England. I don't know if they're still fighting. Love the Commitments. So
they love the Commitments and potatoes. But yeah, people. So what you're saying is, if I can paraphrase.
Yes.
What Greg Lee just said.
Yes.
People who like the Five Heartbeats.
Yes.
Would not find Seinfeld funny.
Possibly. I don't know.
They don't.
I don't know. I'm just saying.
They don't think it's funny.
Oh, okay. Well, then
there you go. You know who I'm talking about.
Okay. But I will say this. I'm not saying it's exclusive to that audience or to that population.
You just think that they should be separated. The audience that likes one yes. and the audience that likes the other.
I think you should not be allowed
for
to
everybody
watch
involved.
Yes.
If,
and like I said,
it was one or the other, but not both.
You're right.
Together,
these movies are separate but equal, is what I'm saying. What did I say?
Listen, when you say it like that, it sounds very equitable.
There we go.
In theory,
there we go. So let's talk about the Five Heartbeats. Now, and I'm saying all joking aside, these are both really good movies. If you haven't seen them, you should check them out. We're going to talk about them one at a time. And, I, you know, pros and cons and measure out which one's the best. The Five Heartbeats, you know, is done by director Robert Townsend, who I actually first saw Robert Townsend do a stand-up comedy in a special, the Young Comedian special in like the late 80s. And he came out and started with a fake British accent. And it was so funny. I actually thought he was British. He was that good. And so did the entire audience. That was kind of his shtick. And he really left an impression. And then he did a movie in the late 80s called Hollywood Shuffle, where he parodied Hollywood. He just did all these little skits and everything in it, and had Keenan Ivory Wayans in it. It's kind of was the start of the Wayans family. And so Robert Townsend here on in the screen image with the Five Heartbeats is the one on the far left. He plays Donald Duck in the, not Donald Duck, like as in the duck, but they just call him Duck. But his real name is Donald.
Didn't we just watch a movie that had Donald Duck Dunn in it?
Yes, we did. Blues Brothers was Donald Duck Dunn. So another duck.
That piece of shit movie.
That actually won. But anyway. So yeah, so I really liked Robert Townsend prior to this film. And what he kind of did was put together, he wanted to, this was like really a big step for him. He had generated a lot of buzz with Hollywood Shuffle. So Hollywood was kind of entrusting him to do the next big thing, you know, and he came up with the Five Heartbeats, which was based on the two really big groups from the 60s, the Temptations and the Dells, who you have on this image here. Temptations on the left, the Dells on the right.
I'm glad you clarified, because I would have really no way of knowing.
Well, there's a little thing down
there. They're very similar looking.
No, the one on the right says the Dells. So if you look at the image, it says that.
Okay, the Dells.
So the Dells.
Do you think Robert Townsend looks back on directing Bill Cosby's Far From Finished television special in 2013 and thinks, yeah, I wish I wouldn't have done that?
I don't think he cares.
Okay.
I think it's just one of those things you move on. It's like that
when people ask, Bill Cosby, noted rapist. Noted rapist.
Townsend, you know, I haven't done anything quite recently, but in the early 90s, he was doing a lot of stuff, and this one was kind of his masterpiece at a very young age.
Man, I keep reading that this is a masterpiece, and I liked the movie just fine, but man, I don't know. Like, it was just fine. Like, I don't see much value to it beyond that. If you like this style of music, and if you like the Temptations and the Four Tops and the Dells and the probably hundreds, if not thousands, of little like Motown groups that got together, you know, as four part, five part harmony groups performing, then I think you'd like the film. And I think for me, when you have this many characters, man, there's a lot fucking going on.
Right.
And I just kept finding myself like overwhelmed by everybody's problems. And it was like for every one thing that they would show in this film where you're like, oh, well, good for those guys. They won a Grammy. And then it's just 10 fucking kicks in the balls. Like, well, yeah, but then he died, and then the other one was on drugs, and then the other one. And it was like, man, it's hard to really get a lot of positive momentum into this one. And maybe that was just my bad for expecting that a movie about an amalgamation of multiple acts of the time would be uplifting. But man,
well, you know what? You make a good point. And this image here is the beginning of the film where Duck gets an invitation, and then it kind of goes where he looks back on their career. And one of the reasons Townsend said he wanted to make this film was because he was a big fan of the Temptations. And when they broke up, it was kind of the coming of age moment for him, where, you know, that was his group as a kid. And then now they were disbanded, and it's like you're finding out that Santa Claus isn't real, that these guys are no longer going to be together.
Wait, what?
Exactly. You know, so it was one of those things when you look at the Temptations, for example, is that they had an illustrious career, and I am a huge Temptations fan. I have several of their albums on vinyl, listen to them constantly. They had a huge success in Motown, one of the iconic groups from Motown, along with Dinah Ross and Supremes and Jackson 5 and so forth. But their behind the scenes was very tumultuous. We all know about David Ruffin and his problems with substance abuse, which is mirrored in the Five Heartbeats. We all know about their internal strife when they, you know, fired David Ruffin. The problems with Berry Gordy as the record producer from Motown, and how he managed acts, and their exodus to California to sign with another label and being able to continue to make music with a new lead singer who wasn't a part of the original group. All these things you see in the Five Heartbeats. It's definitely inspired by that, by the Temptation story. But what you make is an excellent point, is that it's also inspired by so many other stories from like Sam Cooke and, yeah, and like I said, we mentioned the Dells and others. And it's like, you really have so many stories to tell that you're trying to put in a 2-hour film. And when you've got five characters, but then you've got so many other, you got the five main characters and singers, but then you're telling the stories of so many others. That's a super challenge.
Yeah, it's there's too challenge. Many people in the orbit, and trying to get that granular with everybody's story was just a ton. And again, maybe it'd feel better if I'm following 10 different people's stories. Because, yeah, you've got the five, but the manager is a strong six, and the record label guy, Big Red or whatever name. I mean, that's a strong seven. You've just got all of this going on. And I started to feel overwhelmed by it. And I would just like stop watching for a little bit and then like pick it back up. And maybe that's part of it too. You know, there's a momentum to movies. And again, that's not to take anything away from the quality of the movie. And I think it is really well done. I think telling the story, I think it's a really fine line, because if you want to make a Temptations biopic, you can do that. And they have done that. And it would revolve around David Ruffin, right? And he died in a crack house. You know, we know that story. And if you kept it just to that.
You make excellent points on this.
Yeah, like you said, it's Sam Cooke and it's the Penguins and it's just all of this.
I think that what he's going for is the vibe of those times of that 60s and all those groups, because we can't deny that there were so many that were coming up, because Motown was milking them. Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. And the thing about Motown is, one of the things that I've learned, you know, just as growing up and learning about music, Motown was very strict on their artists about wearing suits and the image that they portrayed. So it was like they were under a certain kind of bubble under Berry Gordy. And so in this movie, you don't really have Motown. You have the character of Big Red, who really technically is not, I wouldn't say is like a Berry Gordy type. He's more of a the shyster that kind of comes in with the lower bald record company, that they're not as big a label, and so he can abuse the artist a little bit more. There's an image of Big Red, and he's that slick person. So a little bit of Berry Gordy. Berry Gordy was like, everybody wanted to record under Berry Gordy. And if you remember at the beginning of this film, the Five Heartbeats try to get in with a major label, and they try to give their song to a white group. Jesus. One of the funnier moments of the film.
Okay, that was really great. And I like that at the end we see that the guy has left the Five Heartbeats and is fronting that group as old men. But yeah, they come in and it's like, I don't know, who was that white group? The Four Freshmen?
Four Freshmen, something like that.
Like, yeah. It was like that, like where you're, I mean.
Yeah, it was good.
Listen, there are some soulful white guys out there.
Yes.
Bobby Caldwell, the Righteous Brothers, I think Daryl Hall. Like, there's some guys that can pull this off.
Right.
But, like, most of us can't. That's fine. But it is hilarious putting together, like, a soul doo-wop group. And by the way, you laughed when I said the Penguins. That's a real fucking group, dude. That's a doo-wop group. And okay. They had the song Earth Angel. So
I thought you were being racist.
Fuck you. Penguins are black and white.
Ah, yes.
So
but yeah, so there's some great individual stories in the film. And so the pros of them is like the story of Eddie. I like this, the actor who plays Eddie in here is Michael Wright. He's just, he eats up the screen time when he's on it. I don't think they focused on him enough, in my opinion. I think because they get into his substance abuse, but I think that when he's on the screen, he's amazing. And the opening scene where he's, you know, they're basically showing him as the bad boy. He's in the poker and he's cheating and he jumps out the window and he ends up sliding across the stage right when he has to sing. And yeah. It's just a cool moment and it sets the tone for the film. And I think if I were going to say pros and cons of the film, I would say that the pros are when the film focuses on the five is when it excels the most, and just the five. I mean, the manager, yep, that's fine. The record company, those are things that you don't focus on, but you have to interact with, especially when the record producer is screwing you. But when you have all the other groups and you're dealing with their stories and you're dealing with more in-depth of the manager's stories, you don't see as much of the five. And so when we see Eddie King Jr., we want to know more about his story. So I think, like you said, there's so much in there. Pro-wise is when it's just the five and they're doing their musical numbers, it's an exceptional film. The cons would be when we don't get enough with each of them. I after it was over, I talked about when we watched That Thing You Do and Blues Brothers, and I've watched both the director's cuts of these. There should have been a director's cut of this. There should have been these scenes where we've got Eddie and his substance abuse. We've got even Dresser. You know, we don't know much about that character. Duck is like one of the main characters, but we don't get to know too much of him. And I'm like, we needed a director's cut where we learned about who the five heartbeats were and instead of just the entire world. And I think that there's so much that's covered and it's done very quickly. It's the scene with the choreographer when they bring him in, they bring in the choreographer and it's great. You know, they do that little thing. He introduced and then we don't really see him again, except for like one other scene.
Very end. Yeah.
And so you've talked about in this past on this podcast about Chekhov's gun is when you introduce something, then you have to like follow through with it. You have to, you know, continue. It's got to have a purpose. And if it doesn't, then you're just kind of wondering, well, what the fuck was that all about? Another one is, I can't remember if it was Eddie's father, but the father. Yeah. I think it was Eddie's father. And you get the whole trope of you're going to fail. You're never going to amount to anything. And he says, I only say that because I want him to do better than I did. And that's it. That's pretty much it. You see the father in the audience, but there's no development of that you could have cut that out. It didn't do anything for the film.
Yep. You're absolutely right. That's something you've either got to fully flesh out and explore as the reason for the character acting a certain way or the character being motivated a certain way. But to just throw that, I mean, I found that scene incredibly cringy. It looked like he was reading off of a cue card. And if you're going to do this emotional, which we all want, we want our kids to have a better life and all that, but like, make that feel meaningful and make it feel meaningful within the context of the film where we figure out why that is. But my God, had they gone down that road, we've got more stuff to try to figure out.
Exactly.
A really good example of what you're talking about is Red is introduced as, like you said, the shyster. I don't know if you're allowed to say that word anymore, but.
Oh yeah, that's true. I never. Yeah.
Yeah,
realizing the connotations of that, but yeah, in our day, you could say it. It's just a crooked businessman.
Yes,
yes.
So they introduce him. We do get backstory on this, at least to the extent of he's opportunistic and exploitative, and we know kind of intrinsically that that's going to become part of the problem or part of the plot at some point of this film. It does become a problem. He kind of singles out one of the guys and makes a deal with him. And all of these things happen. And it culminates, spoiler alert, this movie came out, however, 35 years ago. So yep. If you haven't seen it, tough shit. But it culminates in a confrontation between the Five Heartbeats manager and Red.
Yeah.
Red has him killed. And then maybe 25 minutes later, 30 minutes later, they sit down for about 5 seconds and go, tell us everything you know about that night. And then the next thing you know, it's that trope of the newspaper.
Yeah.
And Big Red is found guilty of the murder. And it's like, boy, did we rush through a huge part of the, I mean, I'd have rather just not found out that anything happened to him. Leave it up to me to decide in my imagination whether the guy got away with it or not. Because, man, shoehorning that in there to me felt, again, just cheap and rushed. And
yeah.
Show me a courtroom scene. Show me fucking something. Show me them walking him out of the courthouse with his hands in cuffs. Do something.
Exactly. So what it looks like to me, and what I felt when I watched this. So I'm also a big fan of the Temptations biopic that they did. It's like a two-parter. It was a mini series on TV. Very well done. In fact, Leon, who plays JT in this, plays David Ruffin, and if you haven't seen it, he's really good, and he's the only one from the Five Heartbeats in it, if I'm not mistaken. But when you watch that, it does flow more naturalistic because they're telling a linear true story of the Temptations. And I think this film was kind of like a fantasy version of the history of Motown and the Temptations. And there are parts of it where it's like, it feels realistic. And then you get the murder scene, and then it goes into melodrama. When you have the scene with Bird, the leader of one of the rival bands, and he comes in arguing about his royalties, and they hang him out of the window, and to demonstrate that showed Red's menacing behavior. And it's kind of funny in a way, and it's one of these lines that gets quoted all the time, is where he talks about my office hours are 9 to 5. It's a funny moment. I don't think they needed to take it to murder. I don't think they need to make Red a murderer. He could have just been a dick, and then eventually they get out from under him rather than him committing murder. I think that took the plot into a whole nother realm of melodrama that the film didn't need. Because again, when we talk about, there are certain things that I love about the film that are so, and I'm going to highlight a couple of them. I think the scene with the shy brother thing is so much fun to watch, where Leon is JT. Leon and Duck are brothers. And Leon has this thing, or JT has this thing, where he acts shy and then Duck sets up the girl for him. It's a funny sequence of how he gets a girl, and then it's funny later when they call it back and Duck tries to do it and JT gets the girl again anyway, and Duck comes off looking like he's special, and it's a good moment. These are the things that the film really succeeds in. Another one that I really loved in the film, and I think it kind of changes the tone for a bit, but if it would have stayed with this tone, I think the film would have been better off. It's a sequence with Duck and his sister. Probably one of the best moments in the film, if not the best moment. It was one of those things where, and actually Robert Townsend had to fight for this scene because the producers thought it was too long. It was an extra musical number without any of the Five Heartbeats other than Duck. And he said, no, this is probably one of his favorite scenes in the script. And the fact that he's trying to write this song and he's throwing down the lyrics and his sister picks up the pieces of paper and starts putting the song together. And it's the song's called We Haven't Finished Yet. But then they do this duet and she kills it. It's a great musical number. And my wife was watching it with me and she was like, wow. She's just like, that's just extreme talent right there. You can't do anything about that. That's just beautiful. So it stands out as one of the highlights of the film. And so when the film shifts into dark territory, Now, I'm not saying you had to get rid of the drug thing with Eddie, you know, with him going spiraling, but the murder thing and that whole scene, it really didn't need that to be as impactful as it is.
Yeah, I what you're saying now that I hear you saying it makes a lot of sense to me, and it makes me feel like had we chosen a point of view or a kind of a theme that we were going to stick with, a viewpoint we were going to stick with, or a tone we were going to stick with, I think that consistency would have helped the movie for me a lot. Because you're right, there's too many ups and downs, there's too many, you know, focusing in really at a microscopic level on some things and then zooming way out on others. I don't mean camera work. I just mean from a approaching certain parts of the story standpoint. And yeah, when I started a few minutes ago, I said it was kind of felt all over the place to me. And I think that I was thinking it's because I'm trying to keep up with 10 people's stories.
Right.
And I think that is part of it. But listening to you talk about it, it's starting to make more sense that it felt overwhelming too, because what am I watching? Moving back and forth from, and you can have dramas that have funny parts. You can have comedies that have dramatic, sad parts. You know, Marley and Me is a comedy movie. It's got some sad parts. It's got some funny parts too, like when the dog dies. But it's, you can have that and you can jump around if you do it right. Maybe this one just doesn't quite do it right. There's too much going on to give everything the attention it needs to be successful. That means it's inconsistent and it kind of feels like a mess. And then that starts to make me feel like, well, it's my responsibility as an audience member to figure out what tone you were going for.
Right.
Like, that's your fucking job,
Robert
Townsend, you piece of shit. Working with Bill Cosby.
Don't call Robert Townsend a piece of shit. No, to me, I give him credit for trying something this ambitious, and it doesn't completely stick the landing. But there are so many moments that if it was just edited a little bit better and the script was tightened up, or if you're going to do all of this stuff, give us more time. Because like you said, some of these moments, they just kind of gloss over, like the big red on the newspaper being found guilty. And it's just like we get no payoff for some of the big moments. And going back to some of the, just real quick to wrap this movie up, some of the things that I really liked was the fight scene between Duck and JT when they're arguing. And he rips his jacket, and then they turn it into a positive, and it's really funny. And the fact that they use it to come out with new outfits, and then they make up as brothers. But then on the flip side of that, you have the thing where Duck is proposing to his girlfriend and finds out that she may be or may not be sleeping with his brother, and he follows him. It changes the tonal shift of the film. So you've got the red thing, you've got the drug thing with Eddie, and then now you've got the love triangle thing. So it does frustrate. And another part that I really liked was when they hire Flash to be the new lead singer after Eddie leaves, and they have the dueling soloists where they both sing to the woman, and the poor her husband is right there.
Yeah. She looked like she'd rather be anywhere but sitting there.
And then he leaves. But it's a good moment where they have this. So there's when it stuck with the comedy and stuck with the music, and then just a little bit of drama was when this movie really, really excels. And when it goes, when it overreaches, it's where it kind of falls flat. It has a nice sentimental ending where, you know, the choir boy, who, again, he's got a story in there that is, I mean, the thing about choir boy is that I liked the character because he's in this world and he's trying to stay true to his parents that, you know, that raised him right and want him to be in church. And then he leaves his Bible on the stoop. But then we only really see one scene where he's kind of messing with the ladies. He's got two women, but we don't get much other than that. So he never, like, gets a bunch of girls pregnant, and he doesn't go down a road of sex addiction. And if they did, that's way too much for this film. So we see that he's gone back to his parents' church, and he ends up getting the guys back together, including Eddie, who has recovered from his drug and alcohol addiction and is now singing in the church choir. So again, like I said before, it's kind of a Temptations fantasy. Whereas in the real story, David Ruffin was found dead outside of a crack house in Detroit, Michigan. In this, Eddie, kind of the personification of David Ruffin, is rebounds and turns his life around, and we get a happy ending instead of what reality really is.
It is a happy ending. It ties everything up with a bow. It's kind of the things that you want out of an ending. It's just not everything that we watched made it to the finish line.
Right.
And, you know, again, I don't like having to keep track of, like you said, and like we have said, Chekhov's gun. I don't like having to notice things in a movie because I want to make sure that when it pays off, I'm there for it. But in reality, I'm just keeping mental track of a bunch of shit that's not going to pay off.
Right.
And you're not going to fully flesh it out. You're not going to tell me anything I didn't already know about it. So I don't know. It feels like, and listen, we watched 8 David Lynch films. I can absolutely be challenged by a movie. I mean, I'm still not going to understand it, but I can be challenged by it. But it's a different type of challenge when it feels like a filmmaker leaves it up to you to do the parts that either, I don't know, too ambitious. You know, because you could say too lazy. You right. could say not thought out well enough. But maybe that's not it. Maybe it really was just, I want all of these points to be made. I mean, you know, your English teacher tells you got to write a 10-page paper.
Right.
You write 13 pages, and it's like, well, shit, where do I start cutting out? You know, I feel like I have said everything I want to say within the four corners of this paper, and now I got to start taking stuff out. I'm sure that's a real challenge, but everybody's got that challenge. Right. That's why all these movies could be 4 hours long. And they aren't. I mean, how long was this one?
It's a little bit over 2 hours. And either, like I said, it either could have been longer. It still would have had the tonal shifts. I think what it really needed, because I really like this film, but it is one of those things, like, there are parts of it that you just, it kind of brings it down, so you just kind of tone those out and just focus on the moments that you do, like the musical numbers, the comedy, in the actual story, and then you can enjoy it. And so it's there's so much in the story that does weigh it down a bit, but it's still a good film. I think overall, like you said, it's got a high IMDb rating. People do love the film, and it means a lot to people. But it's just got, like a lot of films, it has flaws that keep it from being a complete and utter dominating masterpiece.
Man, I was about to call you on this, because what was this, number 5?
Yes.
On the list.
It was.
And That Thing You Do is number 6. And I'm like, no way this movie is rated higher than That Thing You Do. And it is. It's a full half a point higher, which on a 10-point scale is pretty big. So I'm surprised by that. And admittedly, I've got like a personal thing for That Thing You Do. It came out, you know, my senior year of high school, like we talked about when it unfairly and unjustly lost to the Blues Brothers. but I guess I was just surprised. I mean, at the very least, That Thing You Do takes exactly what it knows, exactly what it is, sticks with it the whole time, is really consistent in tone, in color, in quality. And even if the highs aren't very high and the lows aren't very low, Woody Chambers says it's a better watch. It's like watching Legally Blonde, where that's not a masterpiece of a movie. Right. The highs aren't real high. The lows aren't real low. But as far as entertainment, and man, maybe that's the opposite thing with Five Heartbeats, where I'm not even sure that there's highs and lows as much as this thing just bounces all over the fucking place.
I think, though, too, you know, they were made in similar times, but this one was made at a time like in the early 90s where there wasn't a lot of tightness in certain films as far as like keeping everything tight. They wanted to hit all these notes, you know, if they're going to cover everything. So that's where the flaws kind of lied in. And like, I agree with you as far as like a tight, really well woven screenplay, that thing you do is better. It's a better watch, except for Blues Brothers, so which is a better watch than that thing you do. But all right, we've talked about Five Heartbeats enough. Let's talk about the movie it's going up against tonight. And I did see this movie in the theater when it came out. I had a buddy of mine who was a huge Alan Parker fan, who was the director of this. He directed The Wall, among many other great films. And so he's known for directing The Wall. So we went, my buddy was like, I got to see this movie. I've heard it's really good. And so we checked it out and I had a great time. I remember seeing this in the theater and walking out of the theater going, that was a pretty good movie. And this was The Commitments, about an Irish man. Yes.
Fucking directed Mississippi Burning.
He did.
That was the feel good story of the year.
Midnight Express. Yeah, that's another feel-good story of the year.
And Angela's Ashes.
Angela's Ashes.
God damn, this guy, is he like a depressive? Life of David
Gale. Not everything, you know. Yeah, he did. Birdie was really good. Yeah, like I said, and The Wall. So yeah, he's a pretty accomplished director, man. He did Fame from the early 1980s, which is a big film at the time. So yeah, he was
going to live forever. He was going to learn how to fly.
Exactly.
Hey!
As like one of the characters says in the movie, I'm gonna live till Tuesday. If you notice, they made a joke about Fame in the film, and Alan Parker was the director. But yeah, so The Commitments is about a young man who's trying to find his way in Dublin. He's kind of like tries to sell things. He goes to the different boot sales, and he just wants to find his way. And his name is Jimmy Rabbit. And he decides, with two of his really good friends, Outspan, I think is one of them name, and then Declan, I think, is the other. But they decide together that they're going to form a group. And this group is going to bring soul to the people of Ireland. And it's something that it's not a prevalent thing in the culture. They make sure they point out that all the different music you see as he's walking around is like, have like the river dance music, the traditional Irish music, the folk music. They're into the 80s stuff.
Yeah, the mod stuff.
And so it's going to be a challenge because this is older music, back, 60s compared to late 80s, early 90s. And these guys are going to try. And Jimmy's got this wonderful idea. We're going to put this classic group together and bring Irish soul to the masses. And it's one of those films that it has a great concept, I think, where the idea of it is conceptually is a great idea. Is we're going to form this group. Now, granted, we've seen movies where groups have been formed. You get that whole forming, thing, and they get that out. But this is a little bit different because not only are they forming and they don't know each other and we're learning new characters as they come together, but they're learning music that they don't know anything about, which I just found is part of the joy because Jimmy starts exposing them to this music. And what's great about it, in the beginning of the film, how none of them had seen James Brown, and he shows him the clip of James Brown, which is a great scene where the guy, he gets to his knees and the lead singer's like, I'm not going to do that. I'll take my knees out. And, and he shows it to him and they're just mystified that they can do that kind of music. And so, but as the film goes along, they start loving the music. It becomes a part of their lives. And by the end, they act like they're experts in it. They start talking the lingo when they find out Wilson Pickett is coming to Dublin and they start talking about Wilson Pickett. People are like, what the fuck? You didn't know who Wilson Pickett was 2 weeks ago, dude. And it's just a really neat concept that it's not only a band getting together and forming in a local community. It's they didn't know this music and they're learning new music and learning together about this. I thought it was a great idea.
I apparently have a new favorite genre of film after watching The Commitments because apparently white people in Ireland start a band movies really resonate with me because The Commitments, which we just watched, was great. Yep. Sing Street, wasn't that set in fucking Ireland?
Yes. And had people from The Commitments in it.
Same thing.
You know, it was in Ireland.
So, yeah. So, apparently, this is right up my alley. Putting a band together and what that looks like and the maturity of bands over time, when you put your band together. And I know this from experience, limited experience, but the excitement of putting a band together, realizing you could make it work. And then just the entire life cycle, you know, every band I've ever been in, I'm now no longer in, which means that it had a beginning. It had, you know, its heyday. It has an end.
Right.
You know, so we get to watch that kind of, so I think that that always is a really good setup for telling a story because it's already built in,
right,
that you've got a blueprint for the way this movie is going to kind of work linearly. And you get to start focusing in on the way we all develop relationships with anybody we meet, because right. At some point, it's the first time you meet someone. Hi, I'm Greg. Hi, I'm Eric. And from there, who knows what happens? We become enemies. We start a podcast together. We whatever. Who fucking knows? So it lends itself to that type of storytelling. Maybe that's what I like about it. Maybe I like the kind of, so Sing Street was a little more underdoggy. The Commitments, not quite as much. But I think that there's, I think maybe I just gravitate towards that type of storytelling where you can pack anything you want to tell. Maybe that's why this group of movies works so well, because whatever story you want to tell, you can do it through building a band,
right,
and how that works. I thought The Commitments was great. I like the style of music. I know you do too.
Oh, definitely.
It's, besides Christian music, it's probably what my parents listen to.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe like older country Western music, gotcha. Like Kenny Rogers and Ronnie Millsap and that kind of stuff. But soul music, you know, I mean, my parents grew up in the 50s and 60s. Right. And so they would listen to that. And so it's funny. Right.
Definitely.
The movie's funny, but like Sing Street and like a lot of these, like it felt to me like it had heart.
Right.
And what was my main complaint about the Blues Brothers, besides that it's a piece of shit movie, it didn't feel like it had any heart. I know to you, it's a frame of reference issue, but to me, it felt completely heartless. I know to you it felt full of heart, and that's fine.
So the Blues Brothers, just to sum up, is that I thought the Blues Brothers, it wasn't a matter of heart, it was a matter that wasn't that type of movie. It was just meant to be this big comedy, one thing to another comedy, and with a lot of music thrown in, which gives it a lot, just it's, that's kind of the heart of the movie, but without having a touching story or any redemption arc. It's really just about these two guys and craziness. With The Commitments, you're definitely right. It's blue collar all the way. And when we watched Sing Street, which I had seen and talked about, I said, man, wait till you see. If you like Sing Street, you're going to love The Commitments because they're really similar films. One of the things that The Commitments has above Sing Street a little bit, and I love them both. I love them both a lot. Is the dialogue writing of The Commitments. There is so many great lines that stick out in my head. And I could watch the film over and over because of the dialogue. For example, this is the scene we've got on screen right now is the audition sequence, which is, it's one of my favorite moments of the film. There's so many great moments. But Jimmy decides to have open auditions in his family's living room, and the influx of people that come in and out, and his dad is masterfully played by Colm Meaney. Doesn't play the trope of the dad who doesn't think his son can succeed. He's not an alcoholic. He's not abusive, but he is a blue-collar dad. And he loves Elvis, and he keeps the photo of Elvis above the Pope. And as these people trudge through his house, and he goes upstairs, and the guy's singing, "Elvis was a Cajun." And Colby's like, "Elvis wasn't a Cajun." Fucking blasphemy. And the scene where all these people are coming in and out, and the guy shows up and he's like, "You know, what are your influences? What instrument do you play?" And he's like, "Well, I don't play any instruments." "Well, what are you here for then?" "Well, I saw everybody lined up and I thought you were selling drugs." So good. And then the one guy where he takes his paper away from him and he goes through the slot. "Can I have me paper back?"
Yeah.
"Fuck off." Another great line is when they meet Joey the Lips Fagan, who is the older gentleman, the trumpet player who's been around and comes into their life to really to kind of guide the brothers. "I'm going to bring soul to the brothers. I'm going to teach the brothers." And in this photo, that's Joey the Lips on the very far right. Another great casting in this. But he tells him that God blows his trumpet, and God told him to come to Jimmy, because the Irish brothers wouldn't be shooting the asses off themselves if they had soul. And then when he leaves, Colm Meaney, his dad, goes, "Who was that?" He says, "God sent him." "Who?" "God sent him on a fucking Suzuki." The guy drives off this little moped. It's one of the best lines. There's so many good moments in the film like that. And one thing I will say, different from the Five Heartbeats, because I don't want to slag on the Five Heartbeats, but one of the things that this is really well written and it shows is there is a very tightly woven story. There is one central focus. They have all these characters. I mean, the Commitments themselves are, you know, 9-piece band, for crying out loud. So many people in the band, but the focus stays on Jimmy Rabbit. The focus stays on the manager. He is in almost every scene, and it's his story. It's his story, what he wanted. And you don't get the cliches, you know, like, again, like a drunken father. You get kind of that normal, everyday, blue-collar environment. "I've got to get instruments. Where am I going to get the instruments from? I've got to pawn things that are very important to me and important to my family." Family heirloom. And needing a transportation and having to break into a garage and getting a chippy van so you can make gigs. And these are minor things, but they're real. And it adds this really great sense of grit and realism to the film that really just reflects soul music, even though these are white Irish guys.
Yeah, Jimmy Rabbit is a perfect vehicle for getting this story from point A to point B to point C, because, like you said, he's in almost every scene, and he's kind of the unifying force. And I guess maybe that's the difference. I mean, we're not here to slag on the Five Heartbeats, but to compare the two films, it felt like he was in control and things were kind of progressing at all times. And in the Five Heartbeats, the manager doesn't seem to have control of these guys. It's kind of like barely hanging on by a thread while they all shoot off in every other fucking direction. You know, I mean, they're two different movies. They're made for two different reasons. But I think that there's some comfort to the way that the commitment story is told and how solid the writing is and how he is used as a way to move one scene to the next, or move time, you know, forward, or move them towards whatever they're working towards at time. You pointed out a bunch of those things. And I think that there's something to, it's kind of a uniquely Irish, English, UK, or whatever it is, where there's just this kind of dark pessimism to the humor that I've always found really funny. You know, people will compare the UK version of The Office to the American version of The Office, and just talk about how just the comedy is a little more harsh in the UK version. It's a little more
for sure
cringy. It's a little darker. It's a little, like I said, more pessimistic and maybe a little more irreverent. And I think in movies like this, it just, it's a positive movie. We're moving a story up and up and up, but there's always just this kind of underlying, like the dad who's just like, fuck this. Yeah. You know, like he's not mean. He's like you said, not an alcoholic. He's not whatever, but he's a blue collar guy that doesn't want to deal with this bullshit.
He's got his own life to deal with. He's got to work.
Who among us doesn't want to deal with other people's bullshit?
One of the best moments. And again, it's like, it's so different than when you've got this dad who is completely an asshole and then he comes around. This moment is like, he's not like totally supportive, but he's not standing in the way either. The fact that he lets his son do this and have this open auditions says a lot about him, even though he bitches about it. One of the scenes I love is when he's working at the bar and his twin girls come in and he's like, how are they doing? Oh, they're really good. Bullshit. He's like, what? No way. And no, they really are. So then he goes over to check it out. And then you catch this brief moment where the camera goes in the audience and you see him. He's boogieing down to the music. It's again, very subtle. And so talking about these extra characters, what I loved about it is that they don't just show the characters and not give you anything, but they give you just enough to give them an identity. So I wanted to talk about the three girls that the commitmentettes, as they're known in the show. And they come in Bernie and Imelda Quirk. And I'm trying to think of the third one's name, Natalie.
Natalie.
They come in and to be the background singers. And while they don't, like I said, they don't dominate the film, but you get just enough to make the film doesn't become about them, but you get to know their identity. You see that Imelda is engaged to Dopey Greg. Yeah, go ahead. But she's engaged to Dopey Greg.
Sounds right.
Exactly. And ends up, you know, kind of putting off her relationship with him and their holiday to be with the band, but it's very brief. You get Bernie, where you get the scene that's here on the screen where clearly is from a very lower class family that's really struggling to get by. She's taking care of all the kids in the household. And there's a scene where she's missing all of the rehearsals. And Jimmy comes to check her out and see if everything's okay. And he's like thinking about moving on from her. And in this scene here, she's, you can't take this away from me, Jenny. This is all I have. And it's like, Bernie doesn't have to dominate the film, but in that one scene, you get to know everything about her. And now you're invested in Bernie.
Yeah.
And then you get Natalie, who of course, all the girls end up having a relationship with the older guy, Joey the Lips. But you get this thing where she has this true blue nature about her. She conveys this, not innocence, but just honesty about her. And you could tell that she has this attraction to Jimmy Rabbit that he rebuffs until the band breaks up. And so they each, and the same thing with the guys too. It's not just the girls. They give you enough of each one of the band members to where you learn their whole story without getting to know too much. The piano player, you get his little church background with the priest, who again, the priest is in it for maybe three scenes and they're hilarious. When they're in the confessional and he's confessing that he's been having impure thoughts. And lately, instead of singing hymns, he's been singing When a Man Loves a Woman by Marvin Gaye. And all of a sudden the priest goes, Percy Sledge. And he goes, what? Yeah. It was Percy Sledge that wrote that killer tune. And I'm just like, this is so funny. There's so many good moments.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think that it kind of goes back to where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Because they didn't try to go down every single road, hit a dead end, realize the story wasn't there, realize that, you know, you've got to make 1 + 1 = 2. And so when it doesn't, you know, when you start going down and go, well, but if we're going to make the character do this, then would he really act like this? And you can start moving off in every direction. And instead of doing that, like you said, just give enough so that we know, we only need to know two things about these characters. What are their motivations and why do they act the way they act? And so if you can accomplish that in a small way, what did you just do? Fucking bomb went off.
I was acting like I didn't do anything. I hit my mic with my hand. I did the little thing. I won't do it again because it was loud.
What a dweeb. Don't do that. Rookie shit. Maybe put the mic somewhere where you're not going to hit it. Let's try to keep this professional. We're about to hire an email marketing firm from Indonesia.
It keeps bumping up against my dick, so I have to move it. So it's not doing that. Well, that's all.
Thing must have the eye of a marksman, huh?
So, but anyway, back to the film.
It feels like with good writing and good planning and forethought, you don't have to go down every road as far as it'll go.
Right.
If you can define what each of these character is and isn't, then you've done what you're supposed to do. And then you start to see how they act as a member of a group. And then you start to realize that what it is that they want is different than something that another character wants. And there will be conflict in that. And you'll, it's just so well done. And if you can do it in one minute scene, and now I know everything I need to know about this person.
Right.
It's brilliant. Brilliant.
You know, and there's one other person I really wanted to talk about when we discuss this film. And again, he's a central part of the film. He's very important to the film, but they don't like force his story down your throat. And that's the lead singer. When they finally find their lead singer, and the way they find him is great. He's drunk at a wedding singing, but he's got the voice. It just got that soul voice. And it's played by Andrew Strong, whose dad was a Irish soul singer, amazingly, who they wanted in the film. And Andrew came along to the auditions and sang a little bit for Alan Parker. This guy was 16 years old when this movie was filmed. Can you believe that? The voice on this guy and the performance is amazing. And he really, like, as far as the front man for the Commitments, he's outstanding. But the trade-off is, in the movie, he's a complete and utter asshole. He's a complete dickhead. We don't need to know why. He's showing us that he could have issues, that he's got problems at home that make him an asshole, whatever. But it's the way he treats the women in the group, the way he treats the other men in the group. Like, at first he's kind of like surprised that he has this talent, but once he starts to realize he has the talent, then he wants to be treated that way. And he's starting to set himself away from the group. And I love the rivalry with him and the first drummer, where his drummer is like, he holds his drumstick up. I'm going to stick this thing in your hole and not the one you sing out of. And they have this rivalry, but it's because he's a dick. He's a jackass, but they have to keep him in the group. And ultimately his attitude and everything kind of brings everything crashing down in the group. But boy, what a performance. And the songs that he sings are just amazing to listen to. These classics.
It's a story as old as time. Lead singer syndrome is, you know, people that you know that are lead singers of bands that are reasonable, normal, well-adjusted people are the exception before they are the rule.
Right.
And, you know, there's a reason that we know that. This kid is fucking 16.
Yes. He was 16 when it was filmed. It's crazy.
Okay, well, I definitely shouldn't have been having some of the thoughts I was having about him as I was watching the movie.
Oh, that's great.
Maybe by the time the Commitments 2 came out, it would have been fine.
There was a plan for Commitments 2. It didn't take off. They were supposed to like reunite in New York and go on a tour of New York City, but it just never developed. So they never did it.
Yeah, but that sounds shitty. Already,
yeah, I'm glad, so. Kind of glad they didn't. It ends perfectly. I don't think you need to take it anywhere other. But yeah, when he sings Mustang Sally, the music, by the way, and I have the soundtrack on vinyl, I'm proudly, I listen to it quite a bit. the girl's solo songs at the, when he sings at the dark end of the street, and I've never loved a man, when Natalie sings I've never loved a man. These are amazing moments in the film of these really good classic songs, and they're sang so well. All of the artists except for Joey the Lips were, they had musical background, and Bernie, the girl who plays Bernie, they had musical background. Glenn Hansard, who played Auspeth, he was in a band called The Frames. He's in another movie called Once that was, that had a song on it called Falling Slowly that was nominated for an Oscar that he wrote and sings. It's a great movie as well. If you like this movie, you'll like Once. It's about a Irish busker who ends up forming a relationship with a immigrant, and they form a music duo. And it's similar in vein. It's a really good film. But Glenn Hansard,
I know Glenn Hansard from Swell Season.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So he's, you know, he's accomplished. The Corrs, who was a very famous Irish band, the one of the members of the Corrs plays Jimmy Rabbit's sister, who, and she's got a few scenes in it, but it's very cute. But yeah, so there's a lot of musical ability in this band. In fact, I remember when the movie debuted, it became so popular after its theatrical run that the Commitments started to go on tour as the Commitments. They actually did like a New Year's Rockin' Eve one time. They did like a TV special. And so it was like a couple of years. They put out a second album that they did afterwards. And so they did, you know, for a little while, they continued to be the Commitments. They actually turned it into a regular thing. But It's a fun film. The, you know, the, without going into too much detail, we can talk about it a little bit more, because I think it's going to be in our final four. But we can talk a little bit more about it next week. But the ultimately, you know, they have this opportunity to meet Wilson Pickett, who is a, you know, soul legend, and the hope is that they can bring Wilson to jam with them, and then that's going to put him on the map. And, you know, that's going to be the big break that they need. And Joey the Lips swears that he can get Wilson Pickett. And you never really know if Joey is telling the truth or not in the film. Is he full of shit? Is he not? Ultimately, they don't get Wilson. Wilson does not show up. But, man, do they crank out a great performance of Try a Little Tenderness at the end of that damn movie. And so you get that. And but it never happens. By the time they have their crescendo, their amazing moment, everything kind of ends for them. They end up fighting, they end up breaking up, and ultimately they disband. And one of the best scenes is when Joey meets up with Jimmy Rabbit, you know, on the street, and he's like, we really could have done something. We really could have been huge. And Joey the Lips tells him, that would have been predictable. This way, it's poetry. And that's just a poignant way of looking at it. And needless to say that after all is said and done, a limo pulls up with Wilson Pickett in it, looking for the club where they were performing. And it's just like one of those moments like, oh man, he was telling the truth after all. It's just, yeah, it's great.
But it's things like that where, yes, it's kind of the impetus for the band breakup. But if it wasn't that, it'd have been the next thing.
Right.
It'd have been the next thing. You know, it's easy enough to look back and, you know, say it was this specific event, but very rarely are really any type of relationship, band or otherwise, kind of the result of one moment. You know, it's just a culmination. Again, the ability to tell a story through a band is, you know, maybe besides sports, probably just like the easiest way to frame what you're trying to say. And just the, again, the growing excitement of putting it together, the, you know, sustained or unsustained heyday into those personality dynamics that start to pull things apart, those external forces, the often substance abuse, all of those things that we know that can separate people in a relationship or in a band. You know, it's never just one thing. And but it is poetry, you know, because that moment feels huge.
Right.
We'd have just made it if, well, you know, maybe, maybe not, but it's easy to feel that way. And it's easy to allow that to kind of magnify some of those existing fissures and cracks that were developing or already existed. And that's the story of most bands. Most bands, you know, end up breaking up over time.
Eventually. You know? Eventually, yeah, for sure. I mean, the ones that stay together the longest, it's really a testament to how they're able to keep the band together. Even Aerosmith, who is still around right now, they had their moments. The Stones had their moments, you know, where it almost looked like the end. Now, the Stones have some longevity. They've really stuck it out through, I mean, I don't know when Keith Richards is ever going to pass away. I think I'm going to die before Keith Richards does. So that, but yeah, the movie itself is a joy. And one of the things that you mentioned there was we talk about the things that bands go through. And the ones that easily come to mind is ego, and you get that in this. But you also get, like we have in the Five Heartbeats, we get the love triangle or the, you know, the interpersonal romances or the drugs and alcohol. And while those things are true, and this does happen in bands out there, it is kind of a trope that's overdone in movies about music bands. And why I think I love The Commitment so much is it doesn't engage in any of those cliches. All we really get is Declan being an asshole, but you don't really even get too far with that other than he's got a temper. The rest of the stuff that really creates their conflict for the film is the saxophonist getting a jazz haircut. That's a big deal. And yeah, he tells him that's, you know, you're spiraling, that's jazz, you're not playing a blue. And so they have that conflict. You have the romance with the three girls with Joey the Lips, but there's no love triangle there. It's just where they're talking about the girls behind their back and they're not showing respect to the women. You get the guy that is questioning whether he should be in this band because he's a good Catholic boy. You know, those are the things that are so refreshing because those are kind of something that a lot of people can relate to. Not all of us can relate to being a rock star and taking a lot of pills and drinking a lot, but we can relate to conflicts that not an abusive father, but a father that's annoyed. And so it feels more real, you know? So I really appreciate this. If you like it, there's actually a trilogy with Cole Meany in all three movies. There's a movie called The Snapper, and I'm trying to remember what the third one was called, but it's done by other directors, but it was based on an author, the guy who wrote The Commitments. It was based on a book. He wrote a trilogy of books about this area in Ireland, and they were about the Rabbit family. And all three have been made into movies. So you should check those out. And Cole Meany is in all three. But he's supposed to be playing the dad, you know, Jimmy Rabbit's father. But I don't think he is in the movies. I think they just renamed him. So just anyway.
The Barrytown trilogy.
Barrytown trilogy.
The Snapper.
And the Van. And the Van. Yeah. So I would check those out. Yeah. Cole Meany, Jimmy Rabbit Sr., in all three, but
I have a van you can check out if you want.
Is it white and say free candy on the side?
Huh?
Yeah.
That's free nice. Candy and free puppies. Hey,
if you've got puppies and Reese's, I'm in. So let's vote real quick. What do you got?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we should vote. I kind of had the sense that, you know what we should start doing?
What should we start doing?
And if we do decide to do it, it'll last like two shows.
Okay.
So starting with the next show, I'm going to record a video. I'm going to send it to you, but you're not allowed to watch it. You can record a video. Don't send it to me. I don't want to watch it. And I'm going to predict which of the movies you're going to choose. And you can predict which one I'm going to choose.
All right.
I'll pretend to be you. So I'll try my best to look like a fucking dickhead.
Nice.
I'll wear my Red Wings jersey. And then you can do the same. You can try to look like super cool, super macho.
Gotcha.
You know, really try to do up like the handsome aspect and like the that whole thing. Like whatever you're doing now, just do the opposite of that.
Yeah, I'm just going to go, I hate everything, me.
I hate both of those movies.
These movies suck, me.
I'm not voting for either, but the one I hated the most was
they reminded me of Beetlejuice, me.
I'm the only one with the courage to not like that movie. Okay.
All right. We could do something like that. We could do that for the final four.
Okay. All right. That'd be fine. I'm going with the commitments on this.
Okay. That sounds
it
good.
It is, for all the reasons we discussed, right. It's compact. It's written the right way. The character development is done the right way. It's an interesting concept. It incorporates a lot of the things that we like about movies, heart and soul. Yep. There's some fish out of water. You know, there's all the things. And it's just, I mean, I'm surprised these are 4 and 5 because I think it's a pretty significantly better movie than The Five Heartbeats. My vote is for The Commitments.
Yeah, and nothing against The Five Heartbeats. Like I said, I watched The Five Heartbeats in the 90s, and I've always liked it. And maybe because I'm a Temptations fan, so I kind of like the idea of what they're trying to accomplish. But watching them back to back, the one that has written, the screen written so well and so tightly edited, and it doesn't overstay its welcome. It is The Commitments. It just is. So we actually had a record number of votes for this one. We had 72 votes on the Facebook page. 64 of them were for The Commitments. 7 yeah. were for The Five Heartbeats, and 1 was a laughing emoji. So I don't know what that was for, but the winner tonight is The Commitments.
Yay.
And The Commitments will move on to the final four that we are going to try to do next week. That's the plan. So we
don't have to watch any movies between now and
we
then.
We don't. So we can just go right in next Tuesday. That's the plan. So these are our final four coming next week. We've got This Is Spinal Tap. We'll go up against The Commitments. And Almost Famous will take on the Blues Brothers. Now, this could go a few ways. This will be up on our Facebook page for the public to vote in. You can pick one of these four films, and we will tabulate all the votes to find out which one is the winner in case Eric and I cannot agree. We'll find out, though. It's okay. Going to be interesting. I think, honestly, after watching all of these, I will say the hardest one will be between Spinal Tap and The Commitments for me.
Really?
Yeah, the hardest choice.
Well, yeah, I mean, it'd be the hardest choice for me, too, because I'm never going to vote for Blues Brothers.
Well, I already knew that. So we'll see if I vote for Blues Brothers again or if I vote for Almost Famous. I don't know. I will
really?
I will reveal that on the night. So that's okay. How it goes. We want to thank everybody for tuning in, whether you watched it on the live stream or whether you watched it or listen to it on the podcast. We want to appreciate everybody. Please make sure you're telling people about the show, and always like and subscribe, hit the make a comment, do all those good things. Whether you're on Spotify, whether you are on Amazon Music, whether you're on Apple Podcasts, or whether you are watching us on YouTube at Box Office Battle Pod or Twitch at Box Office Battle Pod. You can email us at boxofficebattles@gmail.com. We'd love to have your emails. And also, go to our Facebook page and make sure you vote for one of the final four for our movie bands category. So it should be a lot of fun next Tuesday. We'll see where this all goes. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Eric for his final words of the evening.
Yeah, y'all send us an email because we only get emails from Indonesian podcast marketers. We want to hear from you. We want to hear from the real man. Yeah, guys, appreciate all of the support. And remember, until next week, be excellent to each other. We'll see you then.
We'll see you in a week for the final four of Movie Bands here on Box Office Battles with Greg and Eric. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll see you then.